Doug and Joe Hagman, bringing you the news unfiltered, unvarnished. The news that you're not going to hear in the corporate mass media necessarily. Folks, imagine it's Sunday. The election is over. You're either anxious to watch the inauguration, dreading it, or escaping by watching Netflix instead. You rake leaves in the morning and then watch your favorite football team win. You had dinner, and as the long day is winding down, you're watching a coveted DVD with your family. The lights flicker then, and everything goes black. You head to the electric junction box in your basement. Oh, how many times have we done that? Your flashlight shines on all the circuits. They're all tripped. You switch them back, but nothing works. Back upstairs, you check your watch, but the light won't. But the light won't go on when you press the button, and the face is blank. You move to your bay window and look outside. No lights anywhere as far as you can see. Now think about that: darkness everywhere. You pick up your cell phone. You press 911 and nothing. Pick up your electric landline. I think at that point I would know. But you pick up your landline, and there's no dial tone. You check your laptop. It won't boot. You decide to drive to your friend's house across town to see if he's all right. You hop in your car. You turn the key. Nothing. It won't even turn over. So think about that, ladies and gentlemen, that scenario. That is an introduction to the long Sunday, Election Day 2016 to Inauguration Day 2017, nuclear EMP attack scenarios by our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Go to Amazon.com and just put in the, find Dr. Pry's author's page, because all of his books are there, but you might have to type in The Long Sunday in the search bar. It's the price. I don't know. It's oppressive. It's zero. Yeah, it's free with Kindle Unlimited. All right, but it's well worth the read. I do suspect. I have not read it yet. I intend to this weekend. We're so gracious to have as our guest Dr. Peter Vincent Pry for just joining us this hour. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is a man of many credentials, much experience. He's the executive director of the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security, which is a congressional advisory board dedicated to achieving protection of the United States from electromagnetic pulse, cyber attack, mass destruction, terrorism, and other threats to civilian critical infrastructures on an accelerated basis. Dr. Pry, he's also the director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum, an advisory board to Congress on policies to counter weapons of mass destruction. And he served on so many committee staffs. It's just amazing. He was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. Now, this gentleman's got the bona fides to talk to us, to talk to you, and to let you know the threat is serious. Right before the break, he was referencing the long Sunday. Joe, hop on in here, because yeah, we got some many, many questions, and listeners all over the world are actually sending in questions and comments. They love Dr. Pry, and very familiar with him on family security matters, his writings, his works, and agree 100% with the assessment about the Chia Pet over in North Korea. Don't underestimate that.
Dr. Pry, right before the break, we were talking about the remainder of the Obama term and what we have to be concerned about and what we need to watch for up until the inauguration of Trump.
Yeah, I mean, looking at this the way I used to look at things when I was a CIA analyst, trying to stand in the shoes of the adversary, and thinking about, well, when would be the best time to attack? If I was going to attack, when would be the best time to attack? I think this 74-day period between the elections and the inauguration time would be a great time to make an EMP attack or to start a war somewhere in the world, because that 74-day period I call the Long Sunday. You know, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. We're in the shadow of the anniversary of Pearl Harbor as we speak. And they did that on Sunday because they knew that the U.S. Army and Navy were at their least vigilant on a Sunday. Well, the 74-day period is when our preparedness is, we are at our lowest vigilance in 8 years during this period. You know, we've had 8 years of Obama tearing down our military forces, so our military strength is at low ebb. Our nuclear deterrent is at low ebb. It's practically obsolete, and our country is deeply divided. You know, for the first 8 years, we're going through a transition from one president to the next, and the country has been deeply divided over this divisive election. So we're divided from top to bottom, and the government is going through this period. You know, this 74-day period was not conceived of in a modern times. You know, basically dates back to the 19th century when we were an agrarian society, before you could make EMP attacks and cyber attacks at the speed of light, you know. And this is a horse and buggy kind of a transition we've got, where one administration is going to be slowly replaced by another during this defense transition. And the two administrations hate each other, okay? We have a number of holidays during this period. There's an extensive number of holidays. Official Washington is largely absent during this period. Congress is going to go home tonight. And lots of people who are in the CIA, the NSA, the intelligence community are going to be traveling out for the holidays. So our vigilance for this long period is relaxed. And you've got President Obama, still president during this period, the guy who has always backed down. You know, you can cross any one of his red lines. Syria has done it, North Korea has done it, China has done it, Russia has done it, and he's always backed down. So do you want to lose the opportunity when he steps out and you have this new unknown actor, a guy who sounds like he might be tougher coming in? So again, I'm not saying that it's likely that an EMP attack will happen, but I'm very concerned that he might not, that it could happen, and that he has left our defense and foreign policy in such a catastrophe that for the first time, well, I think in history, you know, this country has got to worry about an existential threat perhaps happening, you know, within days or weeks during this period, that it's serious enough that, you know, that we have to worry about it. And we're not going to be out of the woods even when Obama is out of office. I'll be concerned that, you know, as the next president tries to rebuild the military, what will our adversary do? You know, will they give us time? Will they let a Trump administration harden our electric grid and harden our critical infrastructures against EMP and cyber and physical sabotage? Will they give him the time to modernize and rebuild our nuclear deterrent, to rebuild the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force? You know, when they see us actually taking steps to reverse our weakness, will they decide, well, we're not going to let that happen, we're going to take them out now? You know, we, unfortunately, this destructive president, the liberals like to call him, and he calls himself a transformational president, and that is true. You know, he has certainly been a transformational president. He has transformed us from the Ronald Reagan presidency. You know, you remember there was a time not that long ago when there was a book written by a guy named Francis Fukuyama called The End of History. And the thesis of that book is that with the defeat of the Soviet Union and the Cold War by the United States, that the long struggle between tyranny and democracy, you know, between freedom and socialism, or centralized methods of decision-making in the economy and society, had been resolved in favor of freedom. And that was basically, that struggle had, was over with our victory in the Cold War, and the evolution of the world was going to be going in a direction. And for a while, that was true. For a few happy moments, you know, it's almost, we had these Camelot years in the aftermath of the Cold War. It really looked like that freedom might sweep the world. But then this president, in 8 years, has managed to turn that all around. So freedom is on retreat everywhere, and we're now fighting for our lives again. And it's it's heartbreaking. I, you know, I, it's a very depressing thing because, you know, I look at my grandchildren and my children, you know, and we all want to pass on to them. I mean, I was told, you know, when I was growing up, you know, you can lose freedom in one generation. It's up to every generation to pass that on and to pass a better America on. You know, we're going to be the first generation. I don't want to be that generation that is the first generation that has passed on a lesser America to our children, or maybe even has lost America, where we've lost our freedom and even our lives because of these threats. Unfortunately, it's our sad lot to be part of a generation, you know, that is facing that kind of prospect. You know, we've got a chance. We've been given a chance now to turn this around with these elections. You know, I don't want to rain on the parade and make everybody think that we're not going to turn it around, okay? It's a period of hopeful optimism and all the rest. But it is just astonishing to me how quickly the Obama administration has managed to fritter away, you know, the great victory of the Cold War that had been given us by the Reagan administration. And, you know, we've gone from a posture of peace through strength where the concept has been forgotten, just been forgotten by that administration.
Yeah. Kind of switching gears here, you mentioned Iran earlier in the show. The Obama administration struck a nuclear deal with Iran. Did this open up any or expand any EMP threats that are posed to the West and the United States?
Well, the deal itself didn't create new threats. I think the deal the Obama administration struck with Iran is a farce. I think it is no better than, it's been worse, in fact, than Bill Clinton's agreed framework, you know, which was basically a fiction and which was supported by the press and was fundamentally a lie to the American people that Bill Clinton had solved the problem of a nuclear North Korea. Look where we are today. We talked at length about North Korea, and everybody seems to have forgotten during the whole 8 years of the Clinton administration, you know, he was taking credit for having solved that problem. Well, how did that work out? I think the Obama's agreement with Iran will work out no better. In fact, there's really compelling evidence that Iran already has the bomb. I've written articles about this. Jim Woolsey has. I mentioned that Dr. Graham and Fritz Ehrmarth, who had been, you know, chairman of the National Intelligence Council under Ronald Reagan. You know, these are prominent experts. Ambassador Henry Cooper, who had been the director of the SDI. You know, real experts at this have written articles that have been ignored by the mainstream media, you know, that we believe Iran already has the bomb. In fact, that Iran probably has had the bomb, oh, since probably before 2003, for more than a decade. You know, we base this on just some partially common sense, but also a lot of evidence. You know, ask yourself, and you don't need to be an intelligence analyst to come to this conclusion. Let's talk about the common sense approach first. You know, how long did it take the United States to build two atomic bombs and of two completely different designs? It wasn't an implosion bomb that burned plutonium. And the other one was a gun-type device that burned uranium. How long did it take us to come up with those two bombs in World War II during the Manhattan Project? It took only 3 years. 3 years to build two atomic bombs of completely different design, and both of them worked perfectly. One of them wasn't even tested. You know, we didn't even test the Hiroshima bomb. Hiroshima was the test. The one test we had was of the more complicated design, the plutonium device. But both of them worked perfectly when they were first used. So we know from our own experience that even when the first atomic bombs were invented, and nobody even knew for sure that they would work, that you can do it, that they could work, and you could use 1930s, 1940s era technology to build these atomic bombs, okay? 3 years. Now fast forward to Iran. Iran, supposedly, has the Obama administration wants us to believe that Iran has been crashing on the bomb. They've had a Manhattan Project going for 30 years, and they don't have the bomb yet. 30 years. And they've got access to 21st century technology, and they've got all kinds of unclassified information on how to build bombs. You know, the Manhattan Project papers were declassified. You can get a book at a public library by a guy named Aristotle Phillips called Mushroom. And in that, he describes how when he was working as a graduate student at MIT as a school paper, he designed an atomic bomb using unclassified sources. So does Iran not have a library card, you know? I mean, so the design information is there, the technology is there, they've had plenty of time. And then there's this. We know from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is a really bad watchdog, these guys, they basically aren't very good at their jobs, and they tend to be blind. But even the IAEA has come up with some nuggets of intelligence that they published in one of their reports in 2011. And they discovered that prior to 2003, Iran was building bridge wire detonators and neutron generators and had done an implosion test of an implosion device. Now, in the Manhattan Project, when we were building the atomic bomb, you know, when we built bridge wire detonators and neutron initiators and did an implosion test, we were less than 6 months from having the bomb. You know, that's the kind of thing you do when you already understand how the bomb works and you're basically getting ready to put it together. Now, they had all that before 2003. You know, that's, 13 years ago. So, I think the evidence is compelling.
Okay.
That they've...
So, if we're hearing you correctly, Iran more than likely has had the bomb, the atomic weapon bomb, since 2003. And I've been saying that as well. I've interviewed sources ranging from, and you may or may not agree with the sources. It really doesn't matter. I've talked to people like Dr. Lori Milroy. I've talked to people that I'm trying to think of all the people who had. Well, of course that was about a couple of different matters, but anyway, many had said or suggested that, hey, it looks like they've got the bomb. So, what? Again, now, is this a matter, because they've got the bomb, why haven't they used it? Or did you answer that earlier by saying by just having it is sufficient, even if it's not admitted, you know? Or are they waiting for a delivery system? Or are they playing a game where they're, I mean, what's the deal with this?
Well, I'm not sure. There's a couple of alternative theories, okay? The hopeful theory, the theory that I hope is true, is the answer I gave before, that you don't have to go to war when you're already winning and getting what you want. I mean, look what Iran has gotten from the Obama administration. It's hard to imagine they could get more by actually using the bomb. You know, we've abandoned our allies in Israel and Egypt and Saudi Arabia. We've tried to make Iran a strategic partner, we've given them carte blanche. We're helping them. Basically, they've taken over Iraq, and we're helping them take over more in the battle against ISIS. You know, what more do they want? I mean, it's hard to imagine what more they could get. And so they're winning all of these geopolitical, and it's possible. And a part of this theory might be, well, have you ever wondered or considered the possibility, you know, that the reason the Obama administration is doing all these things is because it knows Iran has the bomb too, and it knows it can't do anything about it and doesn't want to go to war with them, all right, and is trying to exit gracefully from the Middle East without provoking them. And so it's engaging in this long policy of appeasement, giving them everything they want because you know, they don't want Iran to attack us. And so, in effect, Iran is winning, and it's not even a naive Obama administration, but it could be a conscious decision on their part. That's another one possibility. another possibility is the Obama administration is just so blind and naive, and they drink their own Kool-Aid so much that they believe their own propaganda. And I think that that's probably the more likely theory. The theory I'm most afraid about, though, is, you know, Iran is not a normal nation state. Iran, it's not like North Korea, you know, where they exist for secular reasons and they have a bunch of secular objectives that they're, and that's what it's about, that they're looking at advancing Iran's national interests. The mullahs don't care about Iran as a nation. The mullahs, for them, this is about the eschatology of Iranian apocalyptic theory in the Quran. These are the end times. It's about meeting the conditions that are necessary for the return of the 12th Imam. The struggle is not an earthly struggle. It's a larger spiritual struggle for the triumph of Iran, both on earth, but beyond the earth, you know, in the spiritual universe. And if Iran, as Khomeini once said, if Iran goes up in smoke to achieve those goals, it's a good trade. Iran is basically a giant nuclear truck bomb heading our way. And why haven't they used it yet? You know, because these guys have a 12th Imam conference in Tehran every year. And what they're doing is they're looking at signs and portents. I mean, these guys are out of the Middle Ages. You know, that's, they're literally, their calendar is literally, if you look at their calendar, by the Iranian calendar, they're in the, they are. It's still the Middle Ages, you know, the 13th century. And they think like 13th century people. They're looking for signs and portents, and maybe the only reason they haven't used it, you know, is because they're engaged in this box-checking exercise, looking at things and developments that they are construing from the apocalyptic predictions in the Quran and in their from their traditions, to see if the time is right to strike the great Satan and strike Israel. You know, it could happen tomorrow. You know, they you know, it might have nothing to do with the kinds of geostrategic calculations and military balances and stuff like that that the Westerners are used to thinking about. This is one of the reasons why it's so crucial to understand that our war with Iran and the terrorists is Islamic terrorism, and we must understand their ideology and how they think. This has been a huge and possibly fatal error. Hopefully it won't be fatal for millions, but the refusal to look and understand the ideological motivations of our adversaries is absolutely crucial to understand the threat. You know, one possibility, have you ever noticed how provocative, I mean, Iran seems to deliberately try to provoke us all the time, like when it took our sailors and humiliated them. Isn't it almost like they're trying to provoke us to attack them? I sometimes wonder that, you know, under Sharia law, under their theory of just war, the final conflict has to be a defensive war from the point of view of Iran, from the point of view of Islam. You know, it's possible, I mean, I'm just speculating here, you know, but maybe what they need in order to be right with Allah before they actually use the bomb and destroy the infidel is they need us to attack. They need us to go in and bomb Iran and actually get in a war with us so that they can be absolutely sure they're good with Allah, you know. And
interesting.
So that's
interesting, and a lot of people don't really understand the medieval nature of the mentality behind that Islamic the Sharia law that whole concept.
Well, we have 2 minutes till we go to the break, but just a quick question: when you phrase it like that, Dr. Pry, it makes me wonder. Well, how come that same ideology isn't transferred to, you know, a lot of the terrorism we see, where it's offensive in nature? And they seem to be, you know, all right in carrying out those attacks along religious purposes, for religious purposes. How come that doesn't transfer with Iran?
Yeah, well, that isn't, those kinds of attacks haven't yet been apocalyptic scale attacks, where you're really engaged in the final battle, okay? The final battle, their version of the Armageddon, where they're going to bring in their best and biggest firepower and do the last battle of the crusade, you know, where you're basically going to exterminate the unbelievers. What they've been doing with the terrorists and all the rest, that's all acceptable, but it tends to be small scale stuff. If you're gonna basically do genocide, it might be. I mean, one could still argue that the point that you're making, that sure, you know, that would be acceptable too. But I suspect the mullahs want to be absolutely sure that they're right with Allah. I mean, I could be wrong about that. You know, it could be some other thing that is some obscure matter of the planets and stars lining up in a certain way. For all I know, I mean, there are so many obscure aspects to their ideology.
Yeah, and you said it yourself,
you know, that could be something else, but I'm just giving these as examples of how they might think about things, you know, that would explain from that ideological perspective why they wouldn't use the bomb yet. The easiest one to think is to think of them as a normal nation state, and that they're achieving their objectives without using the bomb, or by using it for intimidation. Unfortunately, I don't think that theory is true. I don't think they're okay. A normal nation state. I think they're an Islamic state, and we don't understand their motives well enough to know when and why they're going to actually use the bomb. But it will be connected to their views of the end times, and it will definitely be connected to using it to bring back the 12th Imam and win this final struggle.
Okay. Hold that thought, Dr. Pryor. We're up against our last break. We'll be right back with Dr. Peter Vincent Pryor right after this. Stay with us.
Folks, welcome back to the Hagman Report. We are so blessed to have with us Dr. Peter Vincent Pryor. And again, all you have to do is just put his name in the search engine. You will see the credentials of this man. I'm not going to go through them all. The show's not long enough for that. Dr. Pry often appears on TV and radio as an expert on national security issues. And he was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. This gentleman knows what he's talking about, to be sure. Now, you know, since Dr. Pry came on, we really dominated the area of questions that we lobbed over to Dr. Pry. We didn't talk about solutions. We didn't talk about perhaps some things that he wanted to talk about. And certainly we didn't give him a chance to promote his books or his projects, anything that he wanted to do. Dr. Pry, before we go any further, If you would like, if you don't mind, go ahead and tell our audience about where they can find your work, and perhaps direct people into, well, of course, the Long Sunday, that's available on Family Security Matters as well as Amazon for free. But if you want to direct people to your work, where they can find your work, or and then from there, let's talk about whatever you want to talk about for the remainder of the program, solutions or anything else.
Okay, well, I think we have talked enough about my books, which can be, you know, you can get them on Amazon.com or through createspace.com. But I would like to talk about solutions, you know, what people can do. And we are winning this thing. We are winning the struggle to try to protect the electric grid. We've had a huge success just this week. The Critical Infrastructure Protection Act passed the House and the Senate this week. It is a core recommendation of the EMP Commission. We've been fighting for years to get this through, and most people think it will be signed into law by the President because it was attached to the National Defense Authorization Act. And basically, this will require the Department of Homeland Security to start planning for an EMP event to protect the electric grid and other critical infrastructures, and it will add EMP as a national planning scenario. There are like 15 canonical national planning scenarios, and EMP will be a new national planning scenario. All of our emergency planning, training, and resource allocation done by millions of first responders and emergency planners across this country here to the National Planning Scenarios. So for the first time, they're all going to have to start getting ready for the EMP. And I think this will bring such pressure to bear on the electric utilities, you know, that in the long run, it may make it politically impossible for them to resist the pressure to do the right thing and harden themselves and protect their assets. Of course, we may not have a lot of time. So the long run is good enough for me. So we're going to continue to try to push for federal solutions. I would like to change the institutional arrangements so that NERC doesn't run, isn't responsible anymore for protecting the grid, but will to give that to you know, the Department of Defense or something, the actual responsibility of protecting the grid. Now, at the so people could write and call their congressmen, their senators, tell them to join the Congressional EMP Caucus, and become part of the solution. Congressman Trent Franks is one of the leaders of the Congressional EMP Caucus, and he's been leading the fight at the national level to try to get this country protected. At the state level, I wouldn't wait for Washington, though. You know, Washington doesn't do anything. It's not just EMP, but they can't seem to do anything anymore competently. You know, they can't even make a website for Obamacare that works. The government just doesn't work very well at the federal level anymore. I have found, though, my EMP task force, while we've been continuing to try to work at the federal level, we've been focusing a lot of our attention at the states. And the further away you get from Washington, the better government seems to work. You know, through our activities, Maine and Virginia and Florida and Arizona have all passed legislation to protect their people from electric grids and to get prepared from an EMP catastrophe and other threats. So this can be done. You can island a state grid, even though it's connected to the larger regional grid, if you install blocking devices and Faraday cages and surge arrestors on transformers and generators and SCADAs and other vulnerable parts. Even though the regional grid will go down, you can still keep the electricity in your state, the electric grid in your state, working and become an island of survivability. It's literally called islanding the grid, and it was one of the recommendations. So you don't have to wait to Washington, a governor. At the state level, state governments do have the authority to order the utilities within their state to protect the grid. Governors can do it by executive order. The state legislatures can do it by a bill. The public service commissions can do it. In Maine, which is the first state where we started, we started with one person, one state representative. Her name was Andrea Boland, and she was a Democrat. And she took this on. And nobody at the Maine state legislature, when we first went to them, they thought that we were crazy. They had never even heard of EMP. But when we sat them down with the experts and briefed them on this, and they brought in Central Maine Power, and Central Maine Power proved to them that CMP didn't know what it was talking about and wasn't doing anything. It took just 6 months from going from nothing and with one person in the state of Maine to passing a bill that was signed into law by the governor. 6 months after 8 years of making no progress in Washington, you know, we started getting grid protected in that state in 6 months. And similar success stories have happened in other states. You know, we're such a small organization. You know, there's only a handful of us. You know, so we're not able to cover all 50 states at once. It's one state at a time. I'm working in Texas now and Louisiana. And your listeners, you know, you can start your own movement there. Get your state legislature, ask your governor to pass an executive order. Find somebody in the state legislature who can take this on and become a leader to do it. And then think of your own family. You don't have to wait for the state to get protected either. I mean, every individual, you know, can do things to protect themselves and their families, and should. You know, have a food supply, have a water supply, get a medicine kit, know how to use it. Have a plan so that you can get through a protracted period without electricity. You know, that kind of plan, it's basically the same kind of thing that you do for hurricanes or tornadoes or any kind of an emergency, except think of the emergency as lasting a much longer time and just have that kind of preparedness. It's a shame that, you know, that we've gotten to a point where people have to be told to prepare, be prepared. You know, my father's generation, the Great Generation, that had lived through the Great Depression and World War II, they were all prepared. That great Republican and Democrat, I mean, they were all, in effect, what we would call survivalists today. In fact, the word survivalist is almost used with derision, and which is a shame how there's been this cultural change in one generation. You know, Americans historically have been survivalists since the founding of our nation. You know, the notion of rugged individualism and self-sufficiency and the pride that you can take care of your own family and that you don't want to rely on government, these are distinctly traits of the American character. They're characteristics that made this country great and free. And my father's generation, you know, they had never, my father never heard of EMP, but if something like that happened, they would have been ready for it because they were ready for anything. You know, they were constant. My mother was constantly, we had a all of our, you know, we only lived on a half an acre, but we had a garden. We ate a lot of our food came out of the garden. My father fed his family during the Great Depression by hunting. He taught us how to hunt and fish, not just for recreation, but because that's how they survived through the Great Depression. You know, these kinds of characteristics, that last great generation, they were like the last of the pioneer stock, you know, and these characteristics, I would also say, this pride and self-sufficiency, this mistrust that the government isn't going to be there for you, and you don't even want to rely on the government, okay? There was a consciousness that the more you depend on government for your survival or well-being, the less free you are. That's just, Americans have always seemed to know that in their bones up until recently. And I think the founders, this unique American character of rugged individualism and self-sufficiency is a necessary thing for us to continue as a free republic. You know, so even if we're not talking about EMP and survival situations, it's a character trait that we need to hang on to if America is to continue to be great and free. But those are the core messages I would like the audience to take away. To act, don't be passive. You know, the government works for you at the federal and state levels. Take an initiative. Try to get them to do something, because this is directly related to your own personal survival. You know, you pay a fortune in taxes to the federal and state governments. Get something out of it by making these guys do their jobs. And then don't trust them to do their jobs, because you're your own best defense against anything. So take the steps that you know need to be taken. It's not that expensive, and it's not that hard to just think it through. It's 90% planning and, you know, and 10% expenditure on the necessaries to be prepared. And, you know, if we recapture, if most of the population recaptured those virtues that the Great Generation had about rugged individualism, self-sufficiency, and being prepared, would be much, much better posture to survive these threats that we've been talking about, even if the feds and the states, you know, fail in their jobs.
Yeah, and there is, we have different sponsors and people who come on the show and have different methods for protecting your car and your devices, and there are things that people can do individually, even aside from, you know, the state and federal government solutions that can protect different aspects of their own personal life, like the vehicle is a big one, and the scenario.
Yeah, you can protect the car for less than $100, and you know, in a couple of hours of the time of a mechanic. You know, just get some ferrite tubes from an electronics store and hire a mechanic to install them on the long wires in the car's engine compartment. You know, an EMP has to couple into something. It can't couple directly into a semiconductor. You know, the wavelength of an EMP, even from a super EMP weapon, you know, is about a third of a meter to half a meter, you know, so it's got to couple into something about that long. And, you know, in order to follow the wires down to the semiconductor. Now, the ferrite tubes aren't going to guarantee the car will survive, okay? But it'll greatly decrease the vulnerability and increase the likelihood that it would. There are other more expensive things one can do. I mean, you can harden a car so that you'd be absolutely sure. You could do routine things like parking it underground when you go to park it in an underground garage. I mean, that would pretty much guarantee survival.
You know, I have a kind of a just a silly question or a basic question. I don't know. Cars without the electronic systems, pre 1985 cars or cars from the 70s, more likely to survive because of the lack of electronics. That is correct.
Yeah,
that is
correct. Yes.
All right.
But it's not true that you're have one of those cars. You know, you can take a modern car and harden it relatively inexpensively. I don't like, though, that they are, they do these things that make the cars more and more vulnerable and less practical from a survival standpoint. Like, most vehicles, you can't crank the windows down anymore, you know?
Right.
The electronics and the doors have to work, you know? You know, even if the engine works, what if it's hot in the summer? It can become intolerably hot, and if you can't get the windows down, I mean, the car basically is still not useful to you.
See, Dr. Pry, the reason I ask that question seriously, honestly, I should say, is because I'm trying to convince my wife that I do need that 1976 Jaguar. I'm kidding, of course, but trying to justify the purchase. No, again, I'm joking. But okay, so you've really laid out some good solutions. Of course, food, water, your basic medicine. Medical supplies, and being very proactive on a state and federal level.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. You know, give you a good excuse to get a swimming pool. You know,
yeah.
Swimming pool is also a reservoir of water. When you use the chlorinated tablets, try to avoid using the ones that have the anti-fungicide stuff in them, okay? But if you use pure chlorine tablets, I mean, it's basically the same kind of water you get out of a reservoir. That's 20,000 gallons that would last you more than a year, Or, buy, a bucket of chlorine that you use for purifying a swimming pool. And if you know how to use it, you could, that would be enough to provide water for a whole community. A siphon pump, a manual siphon pump, so that you can access gasoline at the gas stations, The pumps won't work in the aftermath of an EMP, but the gasoline is still there. Local fire departments and communities, individual communities can plan and protect themselves. Local fire departments and police departments, they should have siphons, they should have chlorine and special medicine, but most of all, they should have a plan for this sort of thing. Take account of the resources in your community. How much food is there? Where is the water located? Are there public swimming pools? Find one building, maybe an elementary school or something, and rig it up so that you'll be able to provide heat and air conditioning for a protracted period in that one building so that the young and the old, the most vulnerable of our society, would have a shelter, where they could go, to survive in inclement conditions. People would be amazed at how much talent there is among retirees living among them, doctors, engineers. Those people oftentimes are looking for something to do. Put them in charge of coming up with a plan for the community. Anyway, these are just some ideas, about how a community can get ready and prepare itself.
Indeed. Dr. Pry, if I can just veer off just really quick, because we're almost to the end of the program, I just want to ask you, are you more optimistic? And I'm not trying to be political here. I'm just trying to be practical and pragmatic. Given the election results here, are you more optimistic with respect to how things might go in terms of our national security with the Trump victory, or do you see maybe things going sideways domestically?
I'm much more optimistic. If Trump hadn't won, I think that would be it for us. I don't think the country could have survived another 4 years of going in this direction, and I'm not just talking about the foreign threat. I'm talking about I'm talking about the kinds of values we have as a society, you know. The old America, the America that I know, that I grew up with, is being lost to us. It's not being taught at the universities, you know. It still isn't being, even after Trump wins. Our younger generation is being brainwashed. I'm much more hopeful that we can turn these things around, both at the national security level and at the threat that we face from domestic enemies of freedom. And that's what they are. We are actually such a divided society that this isn't the loyal opposition we're talking about anymore, in my view. I mean, you know, these people are actually, you know, hostile to the fundamentals of the Constitution and to what makes us a free people. They're hostile to people that have our values and probably the values of much of your listening audience. I think that opportunity would have been lost. But I'm not as hopeful and optimistic as most people are, however, I would add. I mean, most people are walking on air about this. I think we've been given a second chance, but we haven't won yet. And we've still got a long way to go to get out of the woods. As I was saying before, I mean, even if Trump does everything right, we need our enemies to make a mistake. You know, we need them to make a mistake. We need them to give us time to recover, you know, and to rebuild our military. Unfortunately, Obama's put us in a situation where in order for us to come out of this, we've got to hope that the other side doesn't play a perfect game. They've got to make this strategic miscalculation and let us come back.
I like that analysis that you gave, because I think it's right on the money, with respect to our enemies, the time, the reprieve that we supposedly have, and it's not going to happen overnight. So, very well said. One last question that's really kind of, again, it's, and forgive me for, you don't really have to answer this, but I'm just curious as to your thoughts. Being in the CIA, what are your thoughts with respect to the Hillary Clinton leakage, the emails, all of this? I guess ultimately what I'm trying to determine here is, I've read a lot of books, one by Mr. Klein about the theft of, or the national secrets that were released by the email debacle. From your perspective as a CIA analyst, if you've kept up on this, was America harmed by her carelessness with the server?
I've written an article about this in Newsmax called "Did Hillary Leak Ultra Secrets?"
Yep,
and she in fact did. I think even Hillary critics have missed how fundamental the harm was that she did, okay? The harm that she did goes beyond the classified. And to be sure, the kinds of classified information that she was leaking was enough to send her to jail. I mean, if she wasn't a special protected member of the aristocracy and she was just a normal CIA analyst, she would be in jail for what was leaked. But what she did was much worse than that. You know, in World War II, one of the reasons we won World War II was that we were able to break, you know, the Nazi codes on their cipher machine, okay? Mm-hmm. And we were able to tell what Hitler and his general staff were thinking, all right? And these were called the ultra secrets. They were, because they were the most important secrets that you have, are not necessarily how a tank is designed or how a satellite works. That's the stuff that was classified that Hillary leaked. But there's other things that were disclosed that shouldn't have been disclosed that were even more important, you know? And that is how the President of the United States thinks and how Hillary, our Secretary of State, thinks and what their sensitive and what their advisors. What did they think about the Russian invasion of Crimea? Was it worth going to war to stop that or not? What did they think about the Syrians crossing the red line? Was that worth going to war or not? These guys were able to read her mail, all right? I mean, I think the reason one of the reasons they've been able to win all this time is the same reason we won World War II, because Hillary has been leaking in our ultra secrets, how our national command authorities think. It makes an enormous difference when you can have confidence that you can move this chess piece, because you know how the other guy is going to react for sure, okay? Because you're reading his mail. Deterrence completely fails when that uncertainty is removed, and you know what the other guy is thinking and what his game plan is. And that is even worse than the actual classified, the stuff that's formally classified by the intelligence community. Her personal, her thoughts about these matters, Obama's thoughts about these matters, the advisors that surround them and their thoughts about these matters, is intelligence. Those are the crown jewel to intelligence. Those were our ultra secrets. She was giving up our ultra secrets for years when she was Secretary of State, you know, which is the, after the president, that's the most important cabinet position in the United States of America.
That's right. Yep. And the reason I asked that question, I am familiar with the article you wrote on July 8th of 2016, Did Hillary Reveal Ultra Secrets? I think that article by itself, Dr. Pry, was one of the most insightful articles, because that gave an entirely new direction and complexion to the email issue. And that really struck at the heart, especially you being a CIA analyst, within the CIA and your position there, understanding what happened. So I want to thank you for that, and thank you for all of the information that you've given us tonight. We're at the end of the program. I thank you for appearing with us, and thank you for your gift of time. You're very gracious. And
thank you for giving me a forum here and for being so well read and the stuff that I've written. And I want to thank you and your audience, because all of you, by coming to understand these issues better, become part of the solution. You are part of the solution by providing a forum for the discussion of these ideas. And everybody listening here, just by becoming a little better educated on it, has now become a part of the solution. And
amen,
that's
that.
What's
yeah.
necessary for all of us to get through this and come out into broad, uplit fields, as Churchill would say. And they are there. They are there. Let us hope we reach them.
Indeed. Dr. Pry, thank you so very much. God bless you. Please stay safe, and let's stay in touch, and we'll be directing people to your writings and, of course, to your books. And again, thank you for your gift of time. God bless.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, sir.
Have a great night.
Wow, folks, that was Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. What a fantastic source of information. Joe, he really just hit it out of the park. And
we covered the whole range of topics, from natural disaster, EMP related incidents, and the history of that, to the terroristic and the threat of war, EMP. And it is, you know, one of the statistics that shocked me about this category is that how 9 out of 10 people would die within 1 year after an EMP. And that's very troubling to think about. But he said it at the very beginning of the interview. Our Western world is so dependent on electricity. Without it, I mean, what can we do? We have, you know, machines that crop our food.
We'd be watching TV in the dark.
Yeah, watching TV in the dark. Watching that black screen. And to think, you know, when we talked about being at that EMP convention, that it's been so long since that time. It's been about 10 years since we were there, at least. And nothing's changed. Nothing's happened. Nothing's been fixed. And, you know, he mentioned the example of $2 billion a year just to Pakistan, which is how much it would take to harden the infrastructure in order not to have the EMP threat on the United States. But they haven't acted, and that's just mind-boggling.
But see, the thing is, and he said it, we can all make the difference. You know, it's not all gloom and doom. We have we have the ability to be the salt and the light to make the difference, to go out there and say, look, we need to get our act together. Let's do it. Let's do it now. And that's why it's so important that we all must remain. Joe, I believe this. And Dave Hodges was talking about this the other night. We have to stick together. And we do stick together as talk show hosts, as people. And you know what? We are all in this together, aren't we? Oh, hey, stay tuned to the Hagman Report in our Twitter social networking feed for information. Anything does happen this weekend, we're going to be on the spot, Johnny on the spot.
No, nope. Don't forget to tune in to Dave Hodges' The Common Sense Show.
That's right.
Sunday, 8 p.m.
Right.
As each and every Sunday, either my dad or me or both are on with Dave Hodges. And
could be Eric the Tech this time.
Want to thank, Eric, Jackie, JD, John.
John, thank you so much.
For all the hard work this week. Yeah,
and JD, and too. Yeah.
We got a great week in the tank now, and we got a great week ahead of us next week. So make sure you check into this. My dad said Hagman and Hagman.com, HagmanReport.com.
HagmanReport.
We'll be keeping you updated throughout the weekend, and we're starting off strong next week.
Good night, everyone.